Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 35. On this episode, we talk The Giver, another delve into young adult literature. This movie kind of possibly proves that the young adult genre may be a little tapped out as far as films go. Obviously, the books were wildly popular. The Giver is wildly popular. And the reason that we give it the time of day is because this book is probably... inspiration may be a little far, but I don't think it is. It's probably the inspiration for most of the films in the young adult genre that the audiences have loved so much to this point. This includes The Hunger Games and Divergent. So we kind of talk on this episode about the evolution of young adult literature and how that's affected film and what we've been seeing in the theaters. And to do that, I'm joined, of course, by Arian Jones, who is our resident book expert. Also, Elijah Lovejoy, who is always great to have on the show. We talk about the differences in the books. We talk about free will. We talk about deceitful hearts and all the other things that came about from Jeff Bridges finally having a chance to put forth his passion project. So here it is, episode 35, The Giver and Human Choice. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. Elijah is the community pastor.
Executive.
Executive.
And community pastor.
Gotcha.
And community pastor.
Pull out whichever
card is most appropriate.
Yeah.
Do you actually have two business cards, depending on who you're talking to?
Nah, I don't even have one business card. I have a email signature. How about that? Yeah, thank you for your card. I'll email you my card. The signature on the bottom of the blank email.
Wait, don't you have cards?
Me?
Yeah, what did I think? Don't you have cards?
No.
I thought you had cards.
Nope.
I don't even know why.
What would I have a card for?
Just being awesome.
Here, I'm a librarian.
Hey, look, I'm a book reviewer, and people think I'm awesome at it. Here's my card.
Yeah.
You got a book you want me to review? Call me. Don't call me. Email me, because I like reading more.
There's a whole philosophy.
I have no concept of how it works.
There's a whole philosophy of business cards. You know, what do you say about yourself by your card? Is your card slick, or is it matte finish? Is it rounded corners, or heavy, or is it a little paper flimsy thing? You know, colorful or plain? I'm kind of fascinated by that whole thought process.
So the question I have is, are you fascinated by actually, are you going out and examining things because of this idea, or are you just interested because people have this idea?
No, I like when people give me a card asking me what that card tells me about that person.
And this happens?
All the time.
All the time?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, it depends. You have to be in business circles. Like, if you're in a networking, chamber of commerce, meet and greet circles, and you're hey, I'm so-and-so, here's my card. Then you start to see, wow, you have a really cool card, and I'd like to get to know you better. Or, this is the silliest card I've ever seen. I don't even remember. No, I wouldn't say that. But
this card is way too out there and left field. You should totally be the head pastor.
That's right. We don't judge books by their cover anymore. We judge people by their business cards is what we do. No, we don't do that. But I like just kind of daydreaming, imagining what a card might say about somebody. Mm-hmm. Assuming they develop their own card and not work for a corporate company who
dictates it for them?
Dictates it for them.
But then they work for that company, so that doesn't tell us something about them?
Could say something. Yeah.
Like, if they're anxious to give out their card, they're like, I love my card, I love my company. If they don't give the card out, they're like, here's my card. I'll just write it on the back. Don't look at the front. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm all about judging people before I meet them, so that sounds awesome. Squaring somebody up. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a game. I usually don't tell them what I think, and I usually don't necessarily hold that as I will always think of you with my first impression. But it's you know, sitting in a coffee shop and like with a friend and watching strangers come in, and you kind of like who can guess their story, mm-hmm. you know, who can guess the most about mm-hmm. them. Except when you know you actually meet someone, you can actually verify some of those things. So it's like mm-hmm. a rotating checklist in my head. Like, was I right? Was I right? Was I right?
I remember a conversation first year of college after we'd been there a couple months. All these people that had gotten to know each other a little bit, sitting around the room, maybe six or eight people on a couch in a kind of a commons area. Just everybody kind of came clean about what they first thought about everybody else on first impression. It was pretty funny. I mean, how? Most of them were pretty far off.
Was everyone friends afterwards?
Yeah, they're still friends. They're still friends. It was a test of the relationship, okay. But it worked, so they were still friends. And yeah, it was funny.
Huh. Well, I am glad that both of you could be here, and you've never met each other, so that's cool.
No.
Everyone's making connections.
We should talk about first impression.
So what did you think?
Yeah.
She was sitting there, looking all pregnant. Yeah. Who is this person? But we are here to talk about The Giver, and it's kind of odd when I look back at the, well, thinking back about looking forward at the schedule 6 months ago, I was like, man, everyone's talking about The Giver. Mm. Usually I send out, you know, emails, both of you have probably gotten it, that says, hey, you know, what movies are you interested in talking about? What movie, like, there are some movies that no one would sign up for to talk about, which is weird because it always changes, but almost everyone was interested in The Giver. There's lots of buzz about The Giver, like, hey, this is a movie that was sparking so many other kind of young adult / dystopian, utopian movies, or well, books at the time, and now movies, and now this movie's come along, and it's almost gone, you know. Mm-hmm. And we're only like a week and a half out from when it actually aired.
Yeah,
it's gotten fairly poor reviews, but I really thought it was going to come and like kind of land, like. Soundly.
I just think somebody owes an apology to Jeff Bridges. This man works for 20 years to get this movie made, mm-hmm. and he finally gets it made, and he's late to the game. Like, could somebody not have given him a break sooner? Mm-hmm. I mean, before this dystopian young adult genre caught on, and he's kind of his dream is like feels a little ephemeral. I mean, it's kind of like you're saying, come and gone, and didn't make that big of a splash compared to the splash that the book made, apparently, when it first came on the scenes.
I mean, because it seems like it's, I don't know, when you tell someone that you have not read The Hunger Games, people are like, oh, well, I really like this book, you should read them.
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, oh, yeah, you know, you might not like the Divergent series, or whatever else you want to compare it to, but it's usually like, oh yeah, you should read them, or I thought they were good, or yeah, they're pretty good. But like, people, you didn't read The Giver? What? You didn't read The Giver yet?
Mm-hmm.
You know, which people don't give me anymore because they realize that I don't read. That's why I watch movies,
right.
So
but
I can get out of it.
It's also a book that is on a lot of school lists.
Yeah.
So that's that. You know, it's been on some lists for a long time because it was an award winner. So,
which I think is really important to know, because the themes that this book has, they still think that it's cool for children to be reading stuff like this. Mm-hmm. Not that I think they shouldn't be reading, but you know, I think considering some of the things that make school lists or haven't made school lists, it's cool that this.
It also shows you how culture changes. So one of the articles I read said that when this book came out, about 50% of the schools put it on their list, and about 50% of the schools banned it. So it was a very controversial book at the time.
Definitely.
But now you go see the movie, and it's one of the criticisms of it is this movie's boring. It's just repeating same old youth dystopian themes. So, I mean, what a change from banned and controversial to ho-hum.
It's so funny that people say that it's repeating because it was one of the first.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
But the movie came after all of the other ones, and so I think that had something to do with it getting not as great, not being as well received.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I went back and looked because I think I wrote this down. Not that this is the end-all be-all, but like the critics' review on Rotten Tomatoes for this movie is sitting around 32% at the time of recording this, which I was like, really? Really? And I thought I remembered like Divergent being around like 60% or something, so I went and checked because I was like, this really, you know, if people like Divergent, I don't understand why they're not liking this. And I went and I was like, oh, Divergent was like 41%. So it was, you know, it's just trending down because of the fatigue thing, I believe.
I think it's more than that, though. I think it's... In some ways, I think it was a harder movie to make, and I'll say why in a second, but I also think it wasn't as good of a movie on a movie's terms. So I think Snowpiercer, I think Hunger Games, I think even Divergent were better movies, even if there was no book. So let's say that The Giver came out before all those movies. I think it might have gotten a little bump up just for being the first, but I still think it wasn't as good a movie as the others. The main reason is dystopias, by their very nature, are very abstract. So you're taking an abstract concept of a bad or an incredibly bad community, bad in a moral sense or a philosophical sense or a governmental totalitarian sense, and you're trying to convey that in a way that people can understand it. So what this movie didn't do as well as other movies, in my opinion, is it just wasn't as visceral. Like, Snowpiercer was incredibly visceral. Mm-hmm. Hunger Games, quite visceral. It's life and death. This movie, like, the most visceral thing is a flashback, seeing, like, 20 images flood through your mind of random memories. Like, no emotional connection by design, but that kind of hurts you as a movie, too, if there's no emotional connection by design. So I felt like, even though it came late to the game, it still wasn't even a good movie if it had come first to the game.
Well, before we get too deep into the movie itself, let's go ahead and frame everything. So, The Giver is based on a book, which hopefully I'll get Arian to kind of reframe for us in a book sense. But this film, the synopsis is in a seemingly perfect community without war, pain, suffering, differences, or choice. A young boy is chosen to learn from an elderly man about the true pain and pleasure of the, quote, real world. And another kind of review summation was like a utopian society that continues to appear more and more dystopian, which is something I believe we talked about when we talked about Snowpiercer. Elijah already mentioned Jeff Bridges. He actually plays The Giver. He was, I think, the main producer of this film. It's been like a passion project of his to have this made for some time.
20 years.
Yeah. And it also has Meryl Streep as the chief elder, some newcomers, Britton Thwaites.
Australian.
Thwaites.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite things is mispronouncing people's names, especially newcomers, as Jonah.
Mm-hmm.
Father, mother, Katie Holmes. Taylor Swift makes a small appearance. It's a couple big names and a whole bunch of newcomers. Mm-hmm. But it's about par for the course, mostly for what we've seen from other young adult films. You know, a couple big names kind of grounding a whole bunch of new actors that you haven't really seen. And it is based on the book that came out in 1994, written by Lois Lowry.
Yes.
Is it 93 or 94? I read 93.
I put 94. Okay. So Arian can be the tiebreaker. Because she...
I can tell you because I have the book right here, and it came out...
93. So don't believe everything.
You owe me a beer now.
Oh, there you go.
Why would that come from?
You did so well, Liza. Once you finish that beer, there's still one more in the fridge that you can have.
Second one.
So, I mean, Arian, like, you talked about, you know, it's on children's list. It's won awards. Can you tell more about, like, the impact that this had when it came out as a book? And, like, I thought it was, like, a standalone book, and apparently it's not.
Well, like you said, it came out in 93, and it won the Newbery Award. And the Newbery Award is the best children's book that was published in that year. So in 1993, it won the award for the best children's book.
What constitutes a children's book? Like, is there like an age that
yes,
it's meant for?
There
I mean, because
is.
We're talking young adult right now, and like the
so there is a. Also, and I'm not sure in 93 adult award, but there's now. It's called the Prince Award, and that's for young adult. But it came along much later than the Newbery. Newbery has been around for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not sure if in 93 there was a Prince Award or if it was just like they were all kind of lumped together. Because young adult literature has kind of progressed recently and developed into its own beast.
Yeah, it's like its own
beast.
Monster.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
Either way, we're describing it as something scary.
Yes.
Isn't that weird?
What's that, young adult literature?
Yeah, she said beast, I said monster. Notice we didn't say like entity or like wonderful thing. We said, this is scary.
What's going on here, Sabrina? Are y'all scared of your
No, I think it's
side?
Great. I love young adult literature, but it's just grown so, like, so much in the, I mean, I would say the past 10 years.
What's behind that? Is that because everybody considers themselves an adolescent now? So the genre has a bigger and bigger audience.
Wouldn't it be the other way around? Like, no one considers themselves an adolescent, but they all secretly love it, which proves their actual
Maybe. I'm thinking of the sociological trend. Like, you're not truly an adult until you're 26.
I don't really know. There just wasn't a lot around for young adults to relate to as far as like the characters. You know, there were younger characters and there were adult books, and I think it just kind of took off. And I can't even tell. I feel like one of the first young adult books that was written that kind of took off was Judy Blume. And the name of it is completely leaving my mind, but it was a Judy Blume book. And she wrote children's books, young adult, all kinds of stuff.
Is she the Beatles Lightly Toasted one? No. Who's that? What am I thinking of?
I don't think she
Can you toss out some Judy Blume titles? I'm thinking of the two
I've heard her name and I know nothing.
I'm like second guessing myself right now about what are Judy Blume titles.
Well, you keep going and I'll look them up.
Okay, you look them up.
I will look them
because
up.
Because I'm second guessing myself. But I think, didn't she write Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing? Sheila
Blume.
Yeah.
Oh, that B-L-U-M-E. Certainly looks like it.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. You keep talking. Where did I? You go.
I wish I could remember the young adult one that was like her first, and it was a big deal because it had sex in it. So young adults having sex.
So what was your introduction to The Giver? Did you read it when it first came out, or did you read it as a librarian later in life?
I actually was not much of a reader when I was younger. Mm-hmm. I read some in elementary school, like Nancy Drew, Babysitter's Club, that kind of stuff. And then in high school, I was just surviving, I think. I read Cliff Notes for most of the books that we were supposed to read, and
Confessions of a book reviewer right here tonight on the podcast.
Like, I remember reading and watching the movie The Great Gatsby in high school, and I didn't read the book. I read the Cliff Notes, and then we watched the movie. And then it's just in the past 5 or 6 years that I went back and actually read the book. I didn't start reading a lot until I was in college for elementary education, and when I got into my children's literature and adolescent literature classes, that's kind of what re-sparked just my enjoyment for reading. And I started out, when I started out reading, I was reading tons of children's books, tons of adolescent literature, and then it just kind of expanded from there.
I'm going to say Super Fudge.
Yeah. See, I knew I... Does she write Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing?
I don't see it on the list. It looks like...
she did, because it's...
Why is it not listed?
Yeah, it's Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing, Super Fudge, because the character in Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing, the annoying little brother, is Fudge.
Oh, wow, 1972.
Yeah.
Oh, so she's pretty old now.
I wasn't looking far enough back.
Oh, Judy Blume's different, then. Okay.
It's going to drive me crazy if I don't know the young adult one that she wrote.
Okay, so from Tales of the Fourth Grade Nothing, otherwise known as Sheila the Great, Deanie, The Pain and the Great One, Blubber, Forever.
Forever.
Forever?
That's it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, it's Forever. That's one of the first young adult books that kind of made a splash.
A novel by Judy Blume. I feel like we've all learned something today on the podcast. You know, sometimes you can listen. It's like, oh, they talked about some great things, but I never really learned anything tangible. Now we can learn that YA literature really was kicked off by the book Forever, a novel by Judy Blume.
And I'll say that's in my opinion.
Well, that's in your expert opinion.
Expert. We've already established that you're expert. Yeah.
Well, in my grad classes for adolescent literature, we actually started with a book that was before that, and it was extremely boring. Can't remember the name of that one either, but yeah. So in my opinion, my professor might not agree with me, but in my opinion, Judy Blume forever.
So it could have been the start, but there was really nowhere to go but up from there.
That's true.
Well, and my question, having established when it began, is why is it coming back now? Like, we've talked in previous podcasts about these three or four or five or six movies that all come out roughly at the same time with a similar theme. We've talked before about Oblivion, After Earth, Into Darkness.
Oh, yeah,
all
yeah.
All this, like, the world's coming to an end, falling apart. So what's behind all these dystopias coming out at the same time? Like, what are producers trying to tap into culturally?
Well, I was going to say, isn't it more odd that not only were you seeing lots of similar dystopian movies, but the majority of them that at least seem to be making it big in popular culture are all young adult books. So, I mean, like, I think there's an unrest in society and culture right now. Like, you know, no one's happy. Like, no matter if everything was perfect, you'd still complain about something. Mm-hmm. And everyone has, their soapbox, and everyone wants to be an individual. Most of these dystopians are about the suppression of individuality, the suppression of, like, love, or the suppression of, like, feelings, or, you know, like, being an artist, things that are more non-tangible. And it's really odd in a... especially, I think, in our culture, where we move further and further away from things like religion and closer to things like science and fact, that we still turn around and embrace things that are still intangible, like, you know, art and love and things like that, that are, I mean, on the simplest level, some science there. But even like we see in The Giver, you know, like, what is it, direct speech? What is the phrase they use?
Precision of language.
Precision of language. You know, it's still one of those things where you can't use abstract things in a culture that seems to be moving more and more towards, you know, politically correctness, you know, defining things very specifically, only believing in things if you can touch and feel, you know, feel them. So.
And I also think, you know, with... part of the whole dystopian being connected to YA, you know, a lot of young adults during that time feel kind of lost and kind of, you know, they're finding themselves. And in dystopian literature, that's kind of the same idea. You know, the main character is, they think everything is going well, and then everything just kind of explodes and things are not as what they seemed, and they're working through that. So it's kind of like, I mean, I think it's somewhat of a parallel of, you know, what they're going through, just in a different, you know, different setting.
Yeah. It's almost like a metaphor for the pain and anguish of being a teenager.
But it seems bigger than teenagers to me. Like, for Hunger Games to have the box office returns that it did, which presumably we were big enough to make a lot bigger budget for the second movie. Snowpiercer, not as much of a big blockbuster here. It just came late to the United States. But it seems to me like the teenager, using a teenager as kind of the vessel or the messenger of the dystopian fight against the machine kind of dystopian message. Maybe that teenagers or kids in general are more associated with imagination and idealism and these things. And oftentimes it seems to me that the bad guys are the adults or the old people who have gotten kind of curmudgeon-y or controlling or think they know better. And so it sets up a little bit of a generational conflict to help carry out the dystopian message, it seems.
I want
to
say, if nothing else, they're acclimated to the system.
Right.
You know, you're used to doing it status quo. Bucking against, like I said, I think there's a lot of angst there.
And there is a lot of angst. So what I was trying to think of is, are there any individualistic dystopias? Like, it seems to me all dystopias are about the community that sets out to be perfect and then basically gets proven to be oppressive or totalitarian or whatever. I was trying to think of, is there a movie about an individual that sets out to be perfect and then ends up miserable? Because my theory is that it's easy to look at the community and talk about how screwed up the community is when they tried to create the perfect society and they failed. It's a lot harder to look at your own life and say, here's how I set out to try to create the perfect community and how I failed.
Well, is that not what we see in most of our movies, where we have the setup where the hero is
living a seemingly perfect life. You know, it's like a, like when you're writing screenplays or telling stories, it's man with problem. You know, like before he was fine, and then he has a problem that kind of crashes his world down. You know, he's successful. You know, like imagine in the, you know, the first 2 minutes of the movie, we see him walk in, get out of his really nice car, you know, kiss his beautiful wife, you know, maybe pat excellent children, 2.3 children, gives the dog a high five. You know,
and then Iron Man's pad gets blown up.
And then Iron Man's pad gets blows up. Like, you know, like they've created their own individual one. I think the individual thing, to me, looking for a specific example, is almost everyone's problem. You know, almost every movie's problem. The irony there is that they almost never get back to the status quo from before, like their utopia. They always learn a lesson and then alter their reality either around that truth or change themselves because of that truth. So that is that a conversation killer?
No, it's good. And dystopias have conflict between individuals or between components of the community, so it's a little bit harder to depict conflict between aspects of an individual on the screen. Maybe
what's the movie coming out, I should know this. Why I'm asking two people that not the movie guy should know this, but
Dystopian.
No, what's his name and the so awful, terrible, long
Alexander and the horrible, good, very bad day.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I didn't know that's
out. So that's coming out. That's, I mean, at least the trailer itself looks like, hey, these people are living in their own personal, like,
interesting.
You know, like the little older brother's like, you know, once I learn how to drive, everything will be perfect. Hashtag blessed. You know, he's living in his own, and then they all have a bad day. So
okay.
That's based off a picture book, so they're really taking a lot of loose and bounds there.
So we'll do that one. We'll have Arian, I'll be like, wow, what did you really get from the narrative?
Whole book to you.
Yeah.
We'll read it really quickly on the podcast at the beginning. When you think of like people who are like, I don't know, I feel like people enjoy movies that are not like black and white as much anymore. Not, you know, aesthetically or cinematically, which
since
might
there
be
there is black and white.
Yeah, since there's black and white in this movie, but I feel like people, you know, they want gray in their story, they want gray in their characters, which is why I don't think, you know, Christian or movies that are made for Christian subculture type things do very well, because they're typically very black and white. They're never like dealing with the gray, right. Stuff like that. So when you talk about like, is there an example of someone who does this individually? I feel like they usually accomplish their goals. Like The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, you know, he goes out and finds his own utopia.
What I guess I'm not seeing in the individual films is this pursuit of perfection. So in the dystopias, there's oftentimes this rigorous, like, rigid, uncompromising pursuit of perfection. Like, we have to keep the train exactly 73% full, or you have to eat bugs so that the front of the train can survive, kind of thing. Being Snowpiercer, or with this movie, you have to take your injection every day or the world's going to fall apart. So I just don't see a movie where there's this rigid, almost legalistic oppression of self in order to achieve perfection, and then it shows how bad basically legalism for perfection's sake is. Maybe it's just harder to depict for an individual.
Well, I feel like lots of times I see people who are striving for perfection, they're almost always the bad guy.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Like, I just saw Spider-Man 2, and he's striving to have this biological perfection, and he turns out to be a bad guy. So, yeah that's what I was thinking, too.
Well, so, speaking of The Giver, the movie, okay? I mean, we've been going for quite a while now, and we haven't asked the
this is how much we liked it. Yeah, we're talking about all the other movies.
But that's the thing about it. It's sparking conversation about a lot of really great topics. We haven't asked the question we typically always start with, because we've had other great things to talk about. But I mean, as a film, you know, we talked about the book, we talked about how important they are. But as a film, I mean, did you enjoy the film? Ladies first.
I was telling you earlier that this is I just finished rereading the book for the third time.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, like, I wasn't trying. As I'm saying that, I'm like not trying to like throw that out there.
I'm not trying to brag. It just happens.
But I think I had to read it for like undergrad and then grad school, and then so it's been a few years since I have read the book, and so then I went to see the movie. And I was really lost, and I didn't think it was so great in the beginning, and I couldn't even remember why. I was like, why is there black and white? My husband was leaning over asking me. I'm like, I don't know. I can't remember.
It's cheaper.
Yeah. As it progressed, I kind of, like, started remembering some things and was enjoying it more. But I think what made me enjoy it as much as I did was the fact that I had some background knowledge from the book, and I, in all of my warm and fuzzy feelings for it, a lot of it came from the book. Because then when I went back and reread the book this week, I, you know, just remembered how much I loved the book. And it made me love the movie. But I don't know as, like, by itself. I feel like it's a little confusing. It doesn't set up the world very well. And, yeah.
Well, since we talked about the book in comparison to other books, the sub question to did you enjoy it is where, you know, where was it on your spectrum? Because I know especially you are watching lots of these, you know, books made into films.
Yeah.
Like, do you think even though we have this kind of young adult fatigue almost going on by this point, the saturation, like, how did you enjoy it compared to some of the other adaptations that we've seen that are similar?
Still to this, at this point, up until this point, the Hunger Games movies are my favorite. I think they have been the best made movies thus far. Divergent was really, it followed the book really well, but it just wasn't as exciting. I don't know why. I'm not sure what it was about Divergent that wasn't as exciting for me, but it's probably at the bottom of the list as I'm, like, thinking through. Like, The Giver is, you know, I really enjoyed Hunger Games. I like Divergent a lot. But, you know, as far as movies go.
But we're not counting, like, City of Bones, because you didn't watch City of Bones, right?
I did watch City of Bones.
Oh, really?
And then I, you're talking about Cassandra Clare, right? Author?
Yeah, author? No, I have no idea.
You
author,
probably know like who produced the movie and everything. I watched the movie first, and then when read the book, and there's like six of them, and the first book was torture to get through, and I did not continue. So that one, actually, the movie was a little bit better.
It's actually better than the book.
A little bit better than the book.
But the bar was so low.
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so oddly enough, bottom of your list. The Giver. Okay. Elijah?
I like movies that raise interesting questions, so I think this movie, I will differentiate it from the other dystopian young adult movies in this regard, that it raised more interesting questions about knowledge and memory and what knowledge gets passed on and who gets it and why do they get it. So I think there's a lot of interesting lines of thought and questioning and conversation along those kind of how does that apply today maybe type questions. So I like the fact that it raised that. I also thought it did a pretty good job of depicting the innocence and the cruelty at the same time. I thought the best depiction of that was Jonas's dad, this incredibly compassionate man who wants to keep the extra twin and love on him at home and grow him and nurture him and is playful, and his wife's the one that's kind of strict and works for the internal police or whatever, kind of overbearing. And then this same dad is the one who's specifically responsible for killing all the babies. So I mean, that was pretty powerful depiction of that contrast. So I feel like when the movie was able to do that, to show this kind of a visceral depiction of a sharp contrast of some kind that got to you emotionally a little bit or took your breath away a little bit, those are the times that I enjoyed it. For the most part, it was intentionally trying to depict an emotionless world until the end, and I feel like that kind of lost the viewer. Like, if you start off emotionless Whereas Hunger Games, you've got character development, mm-hmm. you've got emotion, you've got fighting, you've got family dynamics, how are they going to survive? And this movie just, it did, I think it hurt itself by being emotionless in the beginning. So it made it very hard to develop affinity for any of the characters until later on when he's excited running around telling everybody what the Giver told him. It's like, oh, I don't really know you that well. I'm not connected to you, so I don't really care that much about what you have to say. So I would give it a C- minus in my movie grading red pen.
Your red pen?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, like, where did it fall in your... Because you saw Divergent, didn't you?
Yeah, I like Divergent. I mean, even if you didn't like the story, I'm a fan of action, maybe. So at least it had good action. And mm-hmm. at least there were some good guys and some bad guys, and they were trying to win. Mm-hmm. And they, interestingly, had a similar scene where everybody was mind-controlled, and they were about to be killed. Mm-hmm. And they had to save their friends from killing each other in a similar way that Jonas had to save... I guess Fiona from being executed mm-hmm. for having received too much memory, I guess. Interestingly, Fiona, I read, was Israeli, and Jonas was Australian. So this had a little bit of an international flavor to of the lead characters. But.
Well, I did have my bar was pretty low going mm-hmm. in on this one because mm-hmm. I read so many negative reviews, and I, of all the people who told me that they, you know, wanted to be on, they wanted to talk about the movie, there were, you know, of all the movies that were late summer, you know, doing that transition to fall, like, this is the one that they knew they were going to go see, and suddenly, like, none of these people were going to find anywhere.
So we're the true and faithful, and true.
Well, I mean, there were still some people who were like, oh, yeah, yeah, but, yeah. you know, everyone was, like, the level of excitement was, like I said, through the roof. You know, we mentioned this at the beginning of the show, and then it just almost has been just a blip on the radar.
Right.
And so maybe it's because my expectations were really low, but, I mean, I kind of enjoyed this movie. Mm-hmm. I came out, and I was like, wow, you know what? It wasn't bad. I mean, like, it wasn't good. Mm-hmm. Like, there was lots of things done from a technical standpoint that were, like, I could tell what they were trying to do, especially trying to tell the story through the lack of color or the color or, you know, like, the flaring, you know, like, the... Just things like that. Like, I understood what they were trying to do, but it was almost disorienting most of the time, and I don't think... that it conveyed as much as it needed to, because there wasn't, as you kind of pointed out, a lot of emotion attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, like I said, technically I don't think it was a great film, but I mean, when I came out of it, I was like, well, I didn't roll my eyes near as many times as I did during like Divergent. I just didn't enjoy Divergent that much. And I think because, kind of like you're talking about too, Elijah, the things that it made me want to talk about, the reason that we're still going to talk about it on this show, mm-hmm. or we're talking about it on this show, is because I could see where all these other movies came from. I was like, these things that I had a fault with, like in Divergent, like these ideas that they're kind of touching on, but it's kind of messy, or like they don't really understand, or they're not articulating them well. I'm like, they're articulating them in The Giver. Yeah. They're basically coming out and saying that this is the conclusion that they've come to, and this is how, you know, it's working. You know, concepts that you take into The Hunger Games, like, you know, like of this society and how it would have to work and how that control would kind of have to work. You can see the beginnings of that or the, you know, the recesses of that from mm-hmm. this movie. Right. And you know, I think it would have been probably more well received if it was first, even though it, like I said, from a movie making standpoint, it's not an excellent movie, or it's not mm-hmm. not even a really good movie. But I did enjoy it, because when I came out, I was like, there are so many things that I'm asking myself now about free will and mm-hmm. love and like what's worth it and mm-hmm. where you make that line. And like, you always want to have bad guys and good guys, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, well, who's the bad guy? You know, is it really bad if that's all they know? If you don't know, mm-hmm. you don't know. You know, most people would say, you know, ignorance isn't kind of an excuse, but you, I mean, like, you have no concept that you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I think it's a great starting point for conversation, and I enjoyed it more than some things. I would say I enjoyed it about as much as I did the first Hunger Games movie, where I was like, that was a movie, and there were some interesting things going on. But obviously, I mean, we talked about it on the episode of Catching Fire, that, you know, they really set their game up between the first movie and the second movie. So the Hunger Games you know, I think is running away with most of this, and they're going to carry that on until the end. But I, like I said, I wish this kind of would have come out earlier, because I don't think we would have been so critical about it. But with that said, like, there were lots of things that were critiqued about this movie because it was different from the book. And Arian, especially since you've reread it for, I mean, probably like the third time now. And I did send that link out because I had never read the book. And people were like, wow, I can't believe they changed the ending, or I can't believe this has changed, And I read like the main differences, and I was like, well, that doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal. It seems like one of those things that you lose just because you translate it to the screen. So, I mean, like, did you feel like it really...
Going back and rereading the book after I saw the movie, I see all the differences. But when I was watching it, and my memory just wasn't very clear as to what happened in the book and what didn't, I didn't really see it. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, that wasn't what was in the book, or that's not how the book was written. The basic idea, and I'm kind of glad that I saw the movie before I reread it, because the basic idea, the message was still... You know, it still came across. I kind of don't like how they made him, because in the book he is getting ready to turn 12. And I think in the movie he's getting ready to turn 16 or 18 or something like that. I didn't really like that, mainly because they threw the love interest in there. And there's Fiona is his, that's her name, right? Fiona. Fiona is his friend in the book, and not really, like, there is one part in the book where he, I don't know if they talk about this in the movie, where he has to start taking the... In the book, he has to start taking pills. It's not like an injection. But when he has the stirrings as a 12-year-old, it's because he's thinking about Fiona. And then he tells his mother about this dream, and he has to start taking the pills. So that's the only instance of... You know, that there could even be like a hint of anything there, but it's kind of blown up.
Wasn't it interesting that I feel like, from a cinematic point of view, or from like a, someone sat down and said, "How can we convey this through a story?" That they wanted to convey love, and the only way that they could choose to do that is adding like a love story. Like there was no like then I guess they didn't assume that audiences would be on board with love. In any other...
I call this the power of the kiss. So the power of the kiss is so strong that you have to mess up a Lord of the Rings movie and add a, insert a kiss into the Lord of the Rings. And same with The Giver. Like, appears nowhere in the book, but you've got to add a kiss in there. And, I mean, what intrigued me is reading about the book was 12... The movie is depicted as 16. In real life, this guy's 25 years old. So this is a 25-year-old playing a 16-year-old who's supposed to be a 12-year-old. But yeah, I mean, you got to make... Interestingly enough, the controversy of the movie was they can't make a 12-year-old kiss another 12-year-old. Like, that's the that's the line they refuse to cross. They say, we got to make him 16 for the...
But
for
that
the
wasn't even necessary, because it...
Right, well, I mean,
I guess
it wasn't...
It was to them.
But to make it a love interest, like, it would have been... I guess gotten the wrong headlines if they'd had, we've got to have a love interest, but it's going to be a 12-year-old, French kissing a 12-year-old. Maybe not.
In the book, the love that is depicted is more between the giver and Jonas.
Interesting.
You know.
Very taboo.
I mean, it's just, it's the male giver. He looks at him.
Is he male or female in the book, the giver?
He's male.
It's a male giver.
And he... And Jonas even at one point talks about how he wishes, he gives him a memory of a family, and the memory of the family, there being a mother and a father and a grandfather and just the whole family. And you know, in the movie and in the book, the family just consists of mom and dad and then the two children that they're given. But in this memory, he sees the grandparents and he looks at the giver and says, I wish you could be my grandfather. Like, I wish, you know.
I'm glad you're old.
And he talks about, you know, and the giver talks about loving, developing love for Jonas. And then and so it's like a grandfather-grandson type relationship that is really the central way that love is shown, and not the,
well, I thought
the girl.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that was in the book because I haven't read the book, but I thought the movie did a pretty good job depicting that from Jeff Bridges' side. Like, at one point, he's mm-hmm. embracing him, he's hugging him, I'm so mm-hmm. sorry, I wanted to shield you from this. Like, he obviously loves yeah. the boy and yeah. loved his daughter. Was it his daughter in the book that got killed as well?
I was a little confused about that.
The previous receiver
of the
brain.
I said it was his daughter.
I don't know if it was, like, actually, even in the book, it wasn't clear if it was actually okay. his daughter or if it was he just called her his daughter because she was, you know, becoming the receiver. So that was very unclear to me. I wasn't sure exactly.
Yeah, what that was I think about. Where I got confused was the fact that the community values the giver and chooses a receiver of memory to become the new giver, and the giver and the receiver of memory obviously connect pretty strongly, mm-hmm. and yet the community, like the movie depicted the giver as this loose cannon mm-hmm. that they ends up being more trouble than help. So I just didn't understand why they placed such a high value on it, and yet didn't really seem to value it.
Well, that was actually
practically.
No, that was one of the things that I wrote down because I said it's odd to me that this society values or finds the giver as a necessary thing.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if I really stand back and think about it, I can understand. You know, you don't want to make the mistakes of the past, but you don't want lots of people to have like be emotionally attached to all these decisions. So you let one person kind of be that, this is what happened in the past, mm-hmm. this is why we made this decision, so I'm just letting you know. And I kind of get that, but at the same time, I don't feel like there was, like, they obviously know, like, he can lie, he can not tell anybody what he does, like, I don't know, I just didn't understand why he was necessarily necessary, or that in a society like this, that they felt so much emphasis needed to be put on this position.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it almost seems like they should have just when he went when they had that choosing or like the assignment of jobs, like the fact that they skipped over him seems like they're putting way more emphasis on it than they actually put on it, kind of like you're saying, Elijah. And I mean, I think it's a great idea to have someone with this, especially if you're going to have a society like this, but
well, and that goes to
where were the scenes of him giving great advice?
Yeah,
you know.
Well, and the one of the conflicts of the movie is how do they appropriate or use the knowledge of the giver? Like, the giver has the kind of this more slow and cautious approach, and Jonas is wanting to run ahead and just tell mm-hmm. everybody. So, one of my questions related to what you said though is, what role does memory play in our society today, and who are the givers and who are the receivers of memory?
Google
is the giver. I could go for that.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I think at one point, not that long ago, you know, there was a really high respect for generational knowledge.
Hmm.
You know, like mm-hmm. whether it's personal, you know, you like your grandpa would tell you a tale about like how he won grandma, or mm-hmm. you know, like
World War II.
Yeah, or give you like something like, you know, moral, you know, this is what we had to do, mm-hmm. or and that would affect you in your personal life. But you would also have mm-hmm. people who would stay with a company for 30 years because they would have like institutional knowledge, and even if they did the job slower than other people, like you respected mm-hmm. the fact that they were there and they knew how to do something that no one else knew how to do. And now if you want to know something, you just go Google it and you don't really care. You're like, it's grandpa, stop mm-hmm. telling me the story so slow.
Mm-hmm.
You know everyone wants information now, and mm-hmm. the giver is Google. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the giver is, I don't even know if it would be
emphasized. I really see a fracturing of memory or a devaluing of memory in a lot of ways. Like, memory has, there's no such thing as objective memory anymore. There's no such thing as memory that's good in and of itself or important in and of itself. I think the only real purpose I see memory serving today is to legitimize or serve a certain cause or a certain ideal or a certain function. So everybody has their own kind of private giver of memory or private receiver of memory. And there's no universal story that one person or one group or lots of groups agree upon to hold this memory in common.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing I think is intriguing is your attitude towards knowledge. Do you try to democratize knowledge so as many people can have access to it as possible, or you try to keep it very hierarchical or even isolated to one individual, as they seem to be doing here?
Well, I think what you kind of express is something I believe that we've talked about recently, going through the book of Genesis.
Mm-hmm.
This was knowledge that was passed down, you know, mm-hmm. like maybe not always specific events, but concepts, you know, mm-hmm. like this is who God is, this is where our people come from, mm-hmm. and this is the importance that's going to play in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right, like people like find a group and they like to attach themselves to it, and you know, most people identify with America when, but unfortunately, I don't think that's all the time. I think that's when it's convenient. No, like we're Americans when like bad things happen to America, but most of the time we're always fighting with each other because we don't have any other identifying purposes. Like the only time the country seems to ever agree on something is when they can all agree that we all hate somebody else,
right.
Or we can all agree that we're at least not somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish we did have more of a common story. And the common story concept is one of the things I love about the familiarity you can have almost with a total stranger through a shared religion. I mean, like, I can really love a book, hypothetically, if I ever read one. And, you know, I could find out the Arian read said book, and we could have a cool conversation, but our conversation wouldn't last very long. You know, we'd talk about a couple of the things about the book we liked, but then outside of that, we don't, like, have this connection. But having a connection that's based on something greater, something that we find eternal, I have met complete strangers, and as soon as we both find out that, like, we share a common faith,
mm-hmm.
like, it opens doors to everything in our life.
Hmm.
Or at least has the ability to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think losing that shared story, especially in our common culture, is mm-hmm. scary.
Hmm.
And when I think about other people who could be givers in our culture, I think of The Daily Show. Because I think The Daily Show completely exists to remind people of what other people said a year ago.
Yeah, I mean, they probably have their own whole Google engine.
Yeah, they have an entire staff of people going back being like, oh, this is what you believe now?
Yeah.
Let's see what you said in 2012.
Yeah.
So, but outside of that, there was this other thing that really struck me about the film, that it was almost like an implied argument that if we had the ability to love, we would do more good than harm. Like, we can make better decisions.
Hmm.
Like, I think even, you know, Jeff Bridges as a giver says that at one point. He's like, we'll do better, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, from watching the movie, I was like, yes, we'll do better. Give them back love. Mm-hmm. We'll make better decisions. And then when I left the movie, I was like, no.
Yeah.
No, we're still human. And at least the way I see humanity, no, we're still going to do just as bad.
And it was Jonas or the giver, I think it was Jonas, that said at one point, you still murder, you just call it a different thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think whether you go to what I would call the suppression route, where you suppress color, you suppress memory, you suppress differentiation, pride, jealousy, it's basically taking a chemical approach or a biological approach to try to create perfection, which assumes that the problem is a physical, tangible DNA problem,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to the assumption of Christianity being that the problem is a spiritual, invisible problem that you can't control through any physical means. And so I think Jonas's words are very appropriate, that, yeah, we had murder before you took over and tried to create the perfect society, but we still have murder now. All you've done is create this precision of language thing that doesn't let us talk about it. And so they end up with the same result. It just kind of has different packaging.
Did I call it sameness in the movie? Because that's what it is, and I can't remember. It's kind of all flowing together now. But in the book, I know they are constantly referring to this idea of sameness and how they want everyone to look the same, and
mm-hmm.
and it never really describes like how they do that. You know, the movie takes it you know, from like the black and white, and everyone looks the same, but the book doesn't really describe like how they make everyone look the same.
Well, it's because in the movie they obviously don't have any black people.
Yeah, I guess they don't. Bicycles, everybody has the same bicycle.
Everybody looks the same,
same
too. Even
same
in the
clothes.
Book, yeah, it talks about how that everyone is like the same color. There are no like really shades of. Yeah, so.
This is really like Nazi engineering at this point. It's like a little Aryan community. Actually, okay, and you said you hadn't read any of the other books in the series.
Yeah.
But I was really curious because, you know, if you see in black and white, like, that doesn't mean that you can't tell something's darker than something else.
Yeah.
And I was like, is there, like, another community where it's, like, only, like, black people or dark-skinned people? Like, genetically, you know, hey, like, you can be dark-skinned in this. Or, like, is there another one with, like, in, like, a Hispanic community where, like, everyone's the same kind of general shade so you don't look different in black and white? You know, because, like I said, even in black and white, you're still going to get
the shades.
The shades, you know, so you can still tell, oh, you're darker than me, or there's there's some way to find and judge and then make yourself better than. So I was curious if that actually happened. And now I have to look that up. Should have looked that up before the show.
I haven't read the other books, but there are three other. It's a quartet, and so it's The Messenger, Gathering Blue, and Sun. And they're on my to-read list. But basically what I understand is that they are depictions of the other communities. And I think it mentions that in the movie, too, that there are some other communities.
Yeah.
But in the book, when he's leaving his community with Gabe, he actually rides through some of the other communities. It doesn't describe them. It just says he's going through them. And so I'm assuming, you know, that's kind of what's happening in the other books. So the other books aren't like Divergent and Hunger Games in the sense that they continue the story. It's just like a different perspective of the story.
A thought slipped my mind. Let's see, what did I have here? Themes of faith was one thing that came up in one of the reviews. The idea of faith, hope, and love comes in his end speech. Seeing faith as seeing beyond. That's what it was. I started wondering if Jonas was at all a play on the biblical Jonah, who in some language translations is called Jonas. Some languages translate his name that way. Kind of this idea of a prophet who has to go to a people who... He's seen something the people haven't seen, and he has to convey a message to them that they probably aren't ready to hear, don't want to hear. In the biblical case, 40 more days and Nineveh is going to be destroyed. In Jonas's case, in The Giver, he's seen that there's oppression and that they're being suppressed in some way, and that there's actually love and joy and emotions and color and passion and all these things. So just the... Is there a parallel there? And then what is the nature of trying to communicate a message to people who are totally and completely oblivious and ignorant of that message? And it even depicts that at one point with him trying to tell his kind of wannabe girlfriend, you know, stop taking your injection. It's true. It can happen. You can see things. Like, there's other stuff out there. And his little sister picks up on that, too. That's not a rhinoceros, that's an elephant or whatever, and becomes curious, but just the process of somebody assimilating new knowledge that kind of revolutionizes their world is a pretty big part of the movie, I thought.
Well, I also thought that do we know if this was specific or not? You know, we don't. And
specific in what
way? Well, anyway, was the Jonas slash Jonah
was that intentional?
Parallel?
Yeah.
She said it, in one of the articles that you sent us, she said it was not intentional. And it was, I was trying to find it, but there were, and she was talking about how there were some other biblical characters, maybe it was in the other books, but how that was not intentional at all. And Lois Lowry says that it was not intentional, which I was surprised.
Yeah, I mean, that's the, well, like, I wondered if she didn't, well, like I said, it seems a little too convenient. Like, of all the names that you could have, well, like I said... And that's why I linked that, because she denies it, and I, you know, I guess we should technically believe the author, but that doesn't negate the parallel.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, even though they have no concept of what Jonas is trying to tell them, and you would think that, and they're probably not ready, but they're surprisingly willing to listen.
Mm-hmm.
At least, you know, most of them are. And so I think the parallel keeps, you know, going. Though where it breaks down, obviously, is that, you know, Jonah in the Bible is like, why are you giving them a second chance?
Right.
And obviously, Jonas in this one is doing everything mm-hmm. he can to, you know, make sure that message is actually changing everyone. So,
it also seems it's a pretty close parallel to Christ, who's come from heaven. He's been in a place we've never been or never seen, but, mm-hmm. but have some distant memories of the whole eternity in our hearts thing.
Yeah.
And, like, we have to approximate Christ by removing a portion of our knowledge and pretending like we don't know that there's color. Like, mm-hmm. that's the closest we can get to there's no color, there's no emotions. Oh, wow, I just discovered color and I just discovered emotions. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how we approximate. That's the best we can do to approximate. I don't know what the ways of heaven are like or the things mm-hmm. of heaven are like, and Jesus has come to reveal that to me. So this theme of revelation, I think, has some pretty strong biblical Christian tie-ins to it.
Yeah, I think the other part is that it kind of makes that subtle case like you're talking about for when I cringe a little bit when people get up and they talk about, I mean, even though it technically says it in the Bible, you know, like the golden streets and the mansions and things like that, I'm like, this has to be a metaphor. You know, this has to be like symbolism because we don't understand. You know, it's like someone trying to describe color when we can only see in black and white. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you even try? Yeah, you just use the closest thing you can.
Yeah.
Because honestly, you know, it's even with marriage, you know, like marriage is great, but it's only, you know, supposed to be like a drop in the bucket mm-hmm. for understanding like how great the love, mm-hmm. You know, of Christ is or God mm-hmm. is for his people. Mm-hmm. And so I can only assume, kind of like you said, maybe you have to understand by subtraction since mm-hmm. we can't understand by the... We don't know right. what we don't know. Mm-hmm. And so I always try to, you know, explain heaven when people tell me, like, heaven sounds boring. Like, I don't want to sit on a cloud. I don't want to just walk down streets that right. waste gold, you right. know, right. And go live in a house, you know, a huge house. Like, that doesn't seem like a reward. I'm like, well, you know, whatever the best thing you think heaven is, it's way, way better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like he's trying to go to them, he's like, you know, you think this is a hippo and it makes you happy, but what this really is way, way better.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I love that about thing. It's one of the things I really liked about the movie, this concept of getting little glimpses into the world
mm-hmm.
and being so excited about these things that are true,
mm-hmm.
you know, this truth that he never knew, that he could not tell people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had to evangelize to them.
Yeah, that same word.
About the color mm-hmm. or about the elephant or about dancing or music, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
So, but we are getting close, so I'm going to ask you guys, what was your come on moment? And, you know, all of us have kind of admitted that, like, this wasn't the greatest film in the world, but surely there was something that stood out more than anything else. So, as always, ladies first.
The black and white was a little weird to me, even after I went back and reread the book and kind of remembered why they did that. I guess that was the only way they could depict it, but it was mm-hmm. still kind of weird. But the main moment for me was the relationship between Jonas and Fiona. I just was not feeling that at all. I was like, you really did not need to throw that in there, but...
Well, I mean, think about how many things they could have really developed to try to show us the other ways that he was learning about love if they didn't just take the...
Yeah.
What I would consider the easy way out. Mm-hmm. And while I felt to a certain degree I was on board with the relationship, like, knowing that it wasn't in the original book, I would say... I was like, man, I didn't mind it in the movie, but now I wish they wouldn't have done it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. I think for me it was probably the whole taking out of emotion thing, and I think it shows how hard it is to make a good movie without rich emotional texture to mm-hmm. the movie. I read one review, I literally laughed out loud. It was in Variety, and I was reading that was talking about Jonas's mom playing this kind of a Stepford wife, like cruel Stepford wife. Said this is a cruel joke making. What was the actress that played
Katie Holmes?
Yeah. It's a cruel joke making Katie Holmes play a role that was on the face of every magazine when she and Tom Cruise were going through all their stuff. But yeah, just the emotion and her role was kind of probably the climax of that lack of emotion and just
until the very end with a tear.
Did she have a tear? I missed that.
Yeah, when the emotions came back, you know.
Oh yeah,
sure. Like it hit everybody, and you know she realized what was happening.
Yeah, which I guess they're just being faithful to the book, but it was, I don't know, maybe it's one of those things that's, it's just a cliche, but it's a lot easier to make a book out of that type of material than a movie out of that, that type of material.
Well, thinking of the idea that you had about Katie Holmes, the guy, I don't know if you're from, if you know this, what is his name, is it? Alexander
Skarsgård?
Is that right?
Skarsgård?
Yeah.
It's probably pronounced way different than Skarsgård because it's got one of those weird circle-y things.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what he is known for playing in?
I can find out.
It's True Blood. He was one of the really bad vampires in True Blood. So I'm like, and those are all based off books that I've read. And so I had a really hard time seeing him as, you know, I always, from the very beginning of the movie, I was like, this is a bad guy.
You're like, no wonder he's killing babies. Yeah. Of course he's killing babies.
Yeah.
So.
Well, while I think all of those were, come on, worthy, I'm going to say that I think it's pretty obvious to basically anyone that Gabe should have died multiple times on his trip.
On the journey.
The miracle that they're making over the cliff alive.
Yeah, I was like, you know, it's one thing to believe in movie magic, like this concept that you can jump down a really, really high waterfall and easily survive, because that's not always a given. But like with the baby in your arms and like the baby not drowning somehow. Yeah. Either via pressure or, you know, it trying to cry. I mean, like, he didn't even have to, like, do CPR or anything, you know? And then, you know, going through the desert with said baby, going through the extreme cold with said baby. I'm just like, this is like Kal-El or something wrapped up in this blanket.
Yeah.
So.
And I will say in the book, the way that he deals with that is he gives him like when they're in the cold, he gives him memories of sunshine and it warms him up. Or like when they're hide from the planes, the planes can't see them because everything looks the same, but they can depict warmth. So he would give him thoughts of being cold so that the planes couldn't see them. So that's how he dealt with it.
Well, because in the movie he said, I gave him memories to strengthen him.
Yeah.
But like most of the other things in the movie, it just says it like really quick.
That's a good point.
We don't. We don't. You know, because even we'll get to that in a second. So let's favorite moments. Let's transition to end on a good note.
Mm-hmm.
Favorite moments.
My favorite moments have to be when he's with the giver, especially towards the end, and they've really developed a relationship. Kind of like why you didn't like it. Like that was my favorite part because that's really the only like. Relationship that there is, and so I really liked their interactions towards the end.
I think mine would have to be probably the relationship between Jeff Bridges and Meryl Streep, and I think Meryl Streep's line at the end kind of was encapsulated the whole movie. When we give people the freedom to choose, they choose wrong. Kind of the whole philosophy behind the dystopian world. It really made me think a lot about redemption and the amazing freedom that God gives in the Bible, even freedom to the point of testing/tempting his creation. So not only is God not trying to create a utopia or a dystopia, like he created a utopia and then he tested in the Eden, Garden of Eden, he tested the people he created to run his utopia and allowed it to fall into some form of almost kind of half dystopia, half utopia.
And they chose wrong.
And he was fine with that. And, I mean, obviously not fine. He didn't like it, but
he had to create this elaborate scheme of redemption.
So just, I like the drama of freedom, mm-hmm. a messiness, and just it made me appreciate redemption more as opposed to trying to not let people choose because they're going to choose wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a huge power there that made me wrestle after I came out of the movie about, you know, like this whole concept of, you know, free will and like the ability to make the wrong decision, and how that doesn't screw up plans if you have, you know, more of an internal or an eternal perspective on how things work.
Mm-hmm.
And it, to me, made love worth risking.
Mm-hmm.
Knowing that, like, ultimately, love, you know, love wins.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like, gosh, every time we get together, Elijah, I want to quote True Detective to you, but I know you haven't seen True Detective.
Haven't seen it.
So you should watch True Detective. So my favorite moment is more or less what you're saying, Arian, like that relationship between the giver and Jonas. But specifically, I really liked lots of the visions. I thought choosing things from history, from our history, not like an imagined history, actually made it more powerful. And unfortunately, it was a disconnect because, like Elijah, like you've been saying, you know, the movie lacks so much emotion, and it was disconnected that it almost felt out of place. But I still liked it anyway. I loved when he was like, you know, I've given you this and I've given you that, but, you know, let me give you strength and courage. And then we see, you know, like the things that human beings are capable of when, like, they're determined and they're passionate. And it was inspiring to me because, you know, I think we forget that we're used to arguing and wanting to get our way and usually complaining because we didn't get it, being very passive, you know, for some of the good they do, the sadness of internet activism, you know, like a very passive way to live life, but seeing there are people who have been so moved by the things that they believe that they were called to action, to stand in front of a tank, you know, mm-hmm. like, and I don't feel like that's something that a lot of people would choose to do mm-hmm. because they don't have things that they're that passionate about. So giving that kind of strength and courage to someone, you know, if once again they would have fleshed it out a little bit better, they would have stuck with it or explained this thing that they threw in, kind of like giving memories to Gabe to kind of keep him going,
mm-hmm.
but not explaining exactly what kind yeah. of memories and how they worked. I wish it would have been done a little bit better, but I really enjoyed that part of it. So,
do they communicate memories the same way in the book? Is it the grabbing of the arms that communicates memory in the book? Like
when he's sharing the memory?
Yeah, sharing a memory.
He's actually laying down, like, I think, like, on, like, face down, and he touches his back.
Interesting. So that's a change, too,
yeah.
then.
It wasn't major. Like, I didn't really think much of that, but...
They're like, this is going to be awkward when you're looking at it.
Yeah, how do you yeah. film somebody's back and make it interesting?
And Jeff Bridges just has that grandfatherly face. You don't yeah. want to bury that in the ground.
Yeah.
No. Well, okay, so any final thoughts, anything we didn't cover that you just wanted to toss out there for people last minute? Would you recommend people seeing it, stuff like that? This is that catch-all kind of question, final moments, mm-hmm. final thoughts, Arian.
Yeah, I mean, especially if you are a fan of the book, I definitely recommend seeing it because, you know, I love the book, and so the movie, you know, I enjoyed the movie because of that. If you haven't read the book, then, you know, you could pass.
Yeah, I would recommend waiting until it comes out on DVD if you want to see it. One thing that I guess would be my final catch-all thought is the relationship between kind of the spiritual establishment and the political establishment, which played out a little bit with Jeff Bridges being the quasi-spiritual mm-hmm. head of the community and then Meryl Streep being the chief elder
mm-hmm.
and this clash between the people who have to crunch the numbers, crack the heads, make sure the trains go where they're going and people do what they're supposed to be doing, and then them wanting to have a more regimented view of society, and then the spiritual and that being in conflict with the vision of the spiritual elder. I think there's some potential. I think it's a good metaphor for some of the conflicts you see today, between like an idealist and somebody who's been in government or corporate world or whatever for a long time. But yeah, I mean, it was. I mean, I think you heard most that I give it a C+, and wait till it comes out on DVD.
What was a C-?
C-, sorry, I slipped. C-, take it back. Wow,
that's like, yeah, that's like almost a whole point better.
Yeah, and that was a slip up.
Well, and this is also funny to me because I feel like before, or you've grown, Elijah. Now, like, you're more comfortable giving actual grades to movies. Even though we tend not to give grades on,
I'm a pro now. You've helped me to become a pro,
and you're giving, like, you know, DVD versus seeing in the theater recommendations. This is
totally.
It's come a long way.
I have.
But well, so for my final thought on the movie or thoughts is I enjoyed it. I don't think it's as deserving of kind of like the, I don't know, the raking over the coals that it's gotten from the critics. I understand the young adult fatigue. I understand the especially young adult dystopian fatigue, but I didn't think it was that bad. Like I said, once again, not that great. I would kind of say, yeah, you know, I wouldn't necessarily pay to go see it, but if you're listening to this, hopefully I already have, or unless you're listening to this way later, which is also really great. You know, I hope you caught it like on DVD or something. I think it's one of those movies that you can put on in a room of people and have a really great discussion for hours, probably afterwards, just kind of talking about where people fell on the spectrum and understanding, like, you know, people would probably choose wrong, you know, but the value of risking for love, all these great themes that we've talked about. So, like I said, I think it's definitely worthwhile. I don't think it was a waste of a film. And I think it would cause great conversation, which, you know, is one of the things that we really appreciate about this. I don't necessarily think it's probably going to shape culture as much as some other films that have come out this year, but I definitely don't think it's a waste. But
You actually raise a really interesting question there. Just a quick thought. How's this going to affect Hunger Games? How's this going to affect The Giver 2? Because, you know, they could make three more movies about this. So will this have a negative effect on the young adult dystopian movie genre in general? Or is this just a blip on the radar? Interesting food for thought.
Well, I think, honestly, it's probably just a blip on the radar. I think we can almost already see that. And the thing about them making more movies around the Giver concept is, I think unless they change the story based on what Arianna said, you know, the movies aren't like sequential like The Hunger Games or Divergent. You know, it's not like this movie, then this happens, then this happens, then this happens. It's like this happened, but in all these other places, other things were happening, or like these other things kind of happen, you know, with different characters. So to continue a franchise like The Giver, you would actually have to, you probably, like I said, unless you change the story some, you're not really talking about having the same characters, you know, like not bringing Jeff Bridges back, likely.
I don't really see the other ones being made into movies. But.
Yeah. And since it's a blip, like I said, the Hunger Games train is, I mean, it's full throttle. Like, people are on board with the Hunger Games. Hopefully it's going to continue to get better. And if that happens, then, like I said, no one's going to stop and remember The Giver. I think, if anything, it's going to make people more fatigued for movies that haven't quite caught on. And I think that's more what Divergent is finding out. I mean, they've already greenlit all the movies, so they're going to make them.
Yeah.
But how much money they're going to make, well, you know, we'll see.
And they already have another series coming out towards the end of the year, dystopian. The Maze Runner is the first one.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, and so... I don't really see that doing well either.
Well, it's from the early buzzes, it's, you know, pretty decent, but I mean, like, we're still talking about like something very similar. So we'll see if people are tired or if maybe the concept's so pocketed or isolated that people kind of give it a chance. But it wasn't really even a blip on. I think The Giver was only because of how people talked about it was probably the only reason that it was a blip on this radar. And I think eventually, you know, lots of people read the book, so you'll eventually get lots of people watching the movie. And hopefully when people watch the movie, eventually they'll listen to this. You know, maybe 3 years down the road, people are like, man, Arianna and Elijah had so much good stuff to say. You know? So anyway, like I said, I think The Giver has, even though the film may not give a lot to culture or to popular culture. I think the book has already given a lot to popular culture because of the book. I think we've seen all the other fruits, you know, like the limbs that have come out from The Giver have deeply impacted, I think, our culture. So
you could raise an interesting question here. Is it harder to make a diverse young adult dystopian movie than it is to make a variety of romantic comedies? Like, is this genre harder to diversify than other genres? Like, is it inevitably you got your totalitarian regime, you've got your oppressed minority, you've got your rebellion or attempt to fight back, or is it just the immaturity of the genre that they haven't developed a lot of the nuanced ways of taking the genre in different directions? I don't know. Whether this is going to quickly tire, or whether it, like, romantic comedies come out, you see maybe half a dozen of those come out a year, so they're still rolling out pretty steadily, with variations on them, obviously. Warm Bodies being one of the kind of most creative variations recently. So I don't know, I guess I'm just thinking out loud whether this is a genre that's going to drive quickly within a few years, or whether it will have long term legs.
Well, I'm feeling it's already drying up from a film standpoint. I think,
Even from a book standpoint, I feel like it's starting to, because, you know, these are just, we've just talked about a few that have been made into movies. There's still probably five or six more series that have been popular, and, you know, the last one that I've read, I don't even think I finished the series. I'm like, okay, I'm done with this.
I get it.
So. Interesting.
Well, I think with the dystopian genre in general, whether it's young adult or not, I think people demand some uniqueness from it. Like, you know, I want a different spin on it. Whereas with the romantic comedy genre, I think people go in and they get mad when it's not.
They want the same thing.
You know, it's not exactly. I mean, else, why would people still read Nicholas Sparks books? I mean,
because they're all the same.
I mean, because they want the exact same thing. I mean, they can try to tell you it's different, but, you know,
it's not.
But it's more or less the same thing, you know, and that's why I think that's what people want. You know, so it's knowing your audience. You know, I think there could be a lot of room for young adult movies, and I think there is. I think we see them all the time. But this particular genre, I think, is probably. It's probably done.
Yeah, I feel like the realistic type young adult movies are starting to take off a little bit now, since, like, with The Fault in Our Stars, and there's some others coming out. So I think that's kind of taking off, where this is dying down a little bit.
I think philosophically part of that is that it's a lot harder to creatively depict evil than it is to creatively depict good or redemption or struggles with good. So if to depict a totalitarian oppression, like, that gets boring. That gets pretty boring pretty quickly. So it's hard to make a whole lot of movies. We can do it on a train. We can do it in a boat.
Especially because of the black and white thing we talked about earlier. You know, like, people prefer gray.
Right.
People even want their heroes gray now. They want their heroes mostly bad because they want redemption, which we could talk about as well. But, you know, usually making someone evil or the bad guy is so hard and so full of holes, and, because you have to typically make them so unidentifiable that you can still call them bad. Because if they're identifiable on any level...
I think that's part of the problem, is that when you try to make them so unidentifiable, then they know they're no longer compelling.
Yeah.
Like, what becomes compelling about a bad guy is, oh my goodness, there's some of me. I see some of me in him. But I really do think that, as I think about it, the only thing that's really changing in a lot of these movies is the setting. So Maze Runner's going to happen in a maze. Snowpiercer's going
to
happen in a train. This one happened on an island. Divergent happened in a, whatever, industrial warehouse or wherever that was. So... It's just kind of different settings, but I think it says something about good and evil, in that the more compelling movies are characters, involve characters who wrestle with good and evil, but aspire to variations on the good and all the things that can look like. So when God created, he created an immense beauty and breadth of creation, but it's evil or oppression is pretty monolithic, unexpressive, uncreative, undiverse. Like, it's blah and bad. And, like, it's hard to get beyond that, it seems to me, is kind of a interesting commentary on this genre.
And that was the final thought.
And that was the final thought. Wait a minute. I thought we had another 2 hours.
Well, how do you follow that? Elijah dropping knowledge bombs on us. Like in
they've got phrases for it now.
Yeah. So, but like I said, I am very glad that both of you were able to join me for this one. Especially, you know, like I said, it's a
new company.
Anytime, you know, a movie isn't like the movie that was going to be like the super hit of the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's always fun to know that there's something to talk about anyway. Mm-hmm. So because of that, I want to make sure that people can follow you, get a hold of you, continue the conversation, hear more things from you. So, Arian, how can people do that?
Well, I sometimes review books on my blog that have been slacking majorly recently. But I do have a book review blog. It's fictionfinders.blogspot.com. We just review books. It's actually a blog that I have with me and a friend of mine. We do it together. I'm on Twitter at Jones at Arian Jones, but you know, I just don't tweet very much either.
Because no one's tweeting at you.
Yeah.
People, you need to get on Twitter 2 years from now when you listen to this podcast and start tweeting her.
Yeah.
If Twitter's still around then.
So yeah. I go in spurts where I use Twitter a lot and then not so much.
But sounds like
you can reach
Twitter.
Me there and mostly the blog, and then mm-hmm. we have a Facebook page for Fiction Finders too, so I respond to that more cool. frequently.
I'm the executive and community pastor at Church of the Redeemer. You can contact me through our website, redeemergso.org. Also, getting ready to start up an outdoor ice rink in downtown Greensboro that I've done for 4 years in a row. This will be our 5th year, so come out and see us at the ice rink as well.
What do you get on Twitter?
I have a dormant Twitter account that is prehistoric buried dinosaur bones somewhere.
Which one?
Party on the Plank, and then I think I did one when I ran for High Point City Council. I think I tried.
Yeah, there
to
was a vote
one.
For Elijah.
Yeah, vote for Elijah.
I was wondering which one you would like grab the torch of and run with.
I can't even remember the handle for either one. So that's how.
I'm following both of them.
That's how dormant they are. Yeah, don't expect great things from the Twitter account. Set the bar low and then be surprised.
Well, I'm still waiting for you to take it back, but anyway. So for all you out there, thanks so much for joining us on this episode. If you want to keep the discussion going, then please follow at Real World Theo on Twitter, which does get it updated occasionally. Or you can follow me at Fizzification, which usually gets lots of retweets of other people that I find interesting. So if you'd like to follow either of those, I would love to have you follow me. But if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then visit our website, realworldtheology.com, R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, which hopefully you've already found if you found the show. Connect with us on Facebook and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, please, please review the show. Leave us some feedback. Tell your friends and let's get more people involved in the conversation. I'm always a sucker for 5-star reviews. I'll do almost anything for a 5-star review, especially from you guys. Again, I just want to thank my guests for being here. Thank you, guests.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I want to especially thank the listeners for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.